How have some Midwestern cities like Grand Rapids managed to not just survive, but thrive by creating manufacturing jobs?
I really do think that in the long run, it's quite possible for the U.S. to have a quite competitive manufacturing sector.
Plus, organized sports can be great for kids of all ages, but medical experts are worried about children who play too much of one sport, and that's because they're seeing more young patients with sports-related injuries. And if you're ready to escape the summer heat in a cool, dark theater, Chicago film critic Reggie Ponder has this for you.
I am very excited about Ocean's 8. It's a women heist film. You have Sandra Bullock, Kate Blanchett, Rihanna, Helen Bonham Carter, Anne Hathaway, Mindy Kaling. This is going to be a very, very fun movie.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, we're getting into the summer swing of things. Later in the hour, the Real Deal critic Reggie Ponder joins us to talk about summer movies. We'll also be speaking with a pediatric orthopedist and athletic trainer to talk about summer sports for kids, how hard that can be on growing children's bodies when they're injured. But first, we're going to talk manufacturing. Often we hear about how manufacturing has been on the decline in the U.S. over the past few decades. Conventional wisdom holds that's because of cheaper labor in foreign countries and the rise of robotics, and the Great Recession didn't help, especially in the Midwest, right? But some new research shows that some local labor markets managed to not just survive but thrive over the past decade when it comes to manufacturing. Take Grand Rapids, Michigan. Its post-recession manufacturing job growth has outpaced the national average. I'm joined on the line now by Tim Bartik. He's a senior economist with the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He's the author behind that research I just mentioned. Economist Jared Bernstein's also on the line with us from Washington, D.C. He was a former chief economist to former Vice President Joe Biden, currently a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Tim, Jared, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So there's lots of policy implications here, but I wondered if we can start with the overall narrative. And Jared, we often hear about the quote-unquote decline of American manufacturing, or that robots are taking all of our jobs. What's behind that, and how accurate do you think that is?
I don't think it's as accurate as a lot of people think it is. There's an impression that our manufacturing sector is kind of disappeared in terms of jobs due to pressure from globalization and from technology, as you suggest. But that's not the case. And in fact, there's some really interesting regional variation that I know Tim will talk about. In both cases, I would say there's been too much of a view that it is inevitable that the United States can't support a more robust manufacturing sector. And I'm here to tell you that that's not inevitable at all. And in fact, it's partly the result of policy that hasn't paid enough attention to the sector, and of policies that we've not enacted that could help it more.
Tim, what made you picked a couple of cities that you focused on. What made you want to look at these cities and how well they've done?
Well, I wanted to see if, in fact, it was possible for manufacturing areas to be successful. And what I found is that when you look at all the local labor markets in the U.S. that are the most intensive in manufacturing, that's the greatest share of their jobs in manufacturing. In fact, you know, roughly one-fifth of them have been reasonably successful over the past 10 years or so, when manufacturing has somewhat stabilized. So in Grand Rapids is one example, Lehigh Valley is another example, and there are others. And some of them have in fact been successful by actually having manufacturing jobs expand. So it is possible for areas to succeed in manufacturing as long as the sector overall is not declining drastically nationally the way it did in the early 2000s. But of course, a lot of that decline nationally in the early 2000s was due to the exchange rate, U.S. exchange rates getting totally out of whack. And that's not inevitable going forward with the right national policies. But as long as we can keep manufacturing jobs roughly stable nationally, which I think is quite possible, areas can succeed if they invest in the right mix of services to manufacturers and the right mix of job skill investments.
So you looked at some larger metropolitan areas or places that had more than a million people. You mentioned Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, Grand Rapids in Michigan, Charlotte, North Carolina, Silicon Valley. I think Silicon Valley is kind of an obvious economic story. But what's going on with these other cities? Do they share some commonalities?
Well, the things you find in common among the cities that succeeded is, one, they tend to have higher skills than other cities. They tend to have a higher percentage of their population that has a college degree or more. So they are able to compete, therefore, in the more advanced manufacturing jobs, or for that matter, in the more advanced jobs in other industries. The other thing they have is they've shown some sizable investments in what I call customized business services. So these are things like manufacturing extension services or customized job training. And what these are services that work with small and medium-sized businesses and try to help them be more competitive. So manufacturing extension is a program that every state has, including Illinois, and the federal government puts some money into it, and then the states put some money into it, and then there's some fees, and they provide essentially low-cost, high-quality consulting advice to smaller manufacturers to help them figure out how to be more competitive in the world economy. And these services have shown very high effectiveness in helping these manufacturers, and it's a way of growing manufacturing jobs in a positive way.
And to that point about jobs, I think we often hear about a skills gap when it comes to manufacturing. Jared, can you first define what that skills gap is that I think people always, this term gets thrown around a lot. Oh, there's a skills gap in manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the term gets thrown around quite broadly, as I'm sure you know, not just for manufacturing. And what it's saying is that there's a gap, allegedly, between the employer's demands for the skills that workers bring when they show up for a job and the skills that those workers have. So for as long as I can remember, employers have basically said, I can't find the workers I want. And oftentimes that is framed as a skills gap. And we certainly hear about that in manufacturing as well. One of the reasons why economists tend to be pretty skeptical of that is if there were truly such a deep skills gap, we'd see more upward pressure on wage offers. And we really haven't seen that either in manufacturing or in any other sector, really, for that matter. Seeing a little bit more of it now that the unemployment rate is so low, at least nationally, as well as in Illinois, relative to where it's been. But the notion of a skills gap gets thrown around without a lot of precision. I would definitely underscore Tim's point that if you're thinking of manufacturing as a bunch of guys, because that's traditionally what it was, kind of standing around a production line just, you know, putting screws into holes, that ain't right anymore. And so, yes, certainly more advanced skills, much more computerization, and by the way, more robotics shows up in our manufacturing sector. But I think it's quite easy to forget that, you know, somebody has to actually build or manufacture those robots. And there's a lot more manufacturing production that goes on than we think, and that could actually be expanded, I think, with smart national policy.
Tim, I wonder if you could, your research does look at Grand Rapids in particular, and I wonder when we're thinking about practical things that they did in Grand Rapids in Michigan, you mentioned manufacturing extension in terms of working with small to medium-sized manufacturers when we were talking about the skills gap as well. What specifically did Grand Rapids do post-recession?
Well, there's a host of things they've been doing. It's not just post-recession. That's really something they've been doing over a number of years. I do think, you know, we need to realize economic development is a long-term game. It's not like you just do things one year and it all pays off in 3 years. You have to make some long-term investments in various services. So the Grand Rapids area for a long time has been trying to make its manufacturing sector more competitive. They bring together clusters of manufacturers' business and discuss common problems. They discuss things like whether or not certain skills are needed. They also discuss how to help businesses diversify. So they, for example, have helped some of their auto parts manufacturers diversify into making parts for various medical, for healthcare industry. So they're trying to diversify into a growing industry. I mean, but if you're taking plastic and making it into parts for autos, you can also take plastic and make it into parts for the healthcare industry. And so they've been working with those individual businesses and clusters trying to help them do that. They have put significant resources into education. They made a successful effort to convince Michigan State to relocate its medical school in Grand Rapids. They've invested heavily in downtown development, which has helped make the area more attractive as a place for people to live. So it's a wide variety of investments that they've been doing, not just since the recession, but really going back 30 years.
And Jared, how much of do you think this requires investment rather than, I think we oftentimes hear of things like business incentives versus, and that's what will bring businesses to a town versus the kind of level investment that Tim is talking about that Grand Rapids devoted?
Yeah, it's a really important question because I would say that most policymakers, we're certainly seeing this now with a bunch of mayors trying to get the Amazon HQ2 to come to their city, really overemphasize the tax incentives versus the kinds of investments that Tim is talking about. In fact, at the end of the day, you might get somebody to show up if you kind of bribe them with enough tax breaks, but it turns out that for the living standards and the longer-term quality of economic life in the places we're discussing, the type of investments that have to do with skills and education, with transportation hubs, with cleaning up brownfields, with infrastructure that's commensurate with high productivity production, so educational interventions of the type that Tim was mentioning, these have a much more lasting impact and ultimately provide a bigger bang for the buck in terms of local jobs. So I think that insight has been kind of missed in the very short-termism pursuit of winning a big kind of contract with one of the big high-name companies that's asking for a tax handout.
And Tim, what did you – go ahead, Tim.
About tax incentives is two things. One is that not all these incentives actually trigger the location decision. In fact, when people try to do serious studies of this, it's pretty hard to find incentives that induce more than 15 or 20% of the incentive jobs. In other words, 85% of the time, the company would have come here anyway, or some similar company would have come here. So 85% of the time, you're just giving out the incentive, not getting anything. 15% of the time, it might trigger the investment. The other thing people forget is you have to pay for these incentives. This is not a free lunch. So how are you paying for these? If you're doing a property tax abatement, for example, where you reduce property taxes, maybe you're implicitly financing it by lowering spending on public schools. And yet we know that investing in public school quality is one of the most effective ways of building up the skills of your local workforce. We have to, once you take account of those two factors, tax incentives is a pretty costly way of trying to create job growth in a local community.
And to that point, when we're thinking about this, Jared, I can't help but think about what's going on here in Illinois. The state's still pretty much in a fiscal crisis. The state's, you know, been taking tax revenue from local municipalities to make up the difference in state revenue. When you're in a situation that Illinois is in, which is a little bit different, I think, than other surrounding Midwestern states, when you don't have the resources to make these kind of investments, how hard is it for a state who can't afford to make investments in infrastructure and these things to try to keep these jobs here?
Well, of course, it's that much harder. I mean, pretty much everything that Tim and I have talked about has involved some level of investment. I think that a lot of times we kind of walk around thinking that there's no way to raise more revenues through our tax systems. And I understand that that's a very tough thing to do for a politician. It's easy for me to say I'm not running for office. But there certainly have been proposals in Illinois to try to claw back some more tax revenue, especially from those at the top of the income scale, and invest it, not just give it to somebody else, middle class or poor people, that actually invest it in long-term productive employment. I also think that in cases like Illinois, but other states, you could say very much say the same thing, there's very much a federal role for that sort of investment. So one of the things Tim mentioned in passing is something that I'll bet almost nobody knows about. It's called the Manufacturing Extension Partnership. And it's a function within our Commerce Department, so it's part of the federal government, and it provides some of the customer customized services that Tim was discussing earlier. I mean, you take a small manufacturer who might be having trouble getting a loan or figuring out a way to, as Tim mentioned, access markets it's not accessing, or even link up to the global supply chain. Oftentimes, a small manufacturer doesn't have the resources to come up with that. Well, the MEP, the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, is this policy group within the Commerce Department that provides this service in every state. And they do it at a very small budget. It's a few hundred million, and I live in Washington. We talk in trillions. So this is something that, you know, the Trump administration wants to get rid of, which I think is a terrible idea. I would double or triple their resources so that they could play more of a role in places like Illinois that are dealing with budget crunches.
Tim, I'll let you have the last word. We're almost out of time, but just very briefly, what do you think the biggest takeaway should be for municipalities, local political leaders looking at this?
It's possible to succeed in manufacturing. Succeeding in manufacturing shouldn't rely on tax incentives, quick fixes that are politically attractive but are pretty costly per job created. You should rely more on trying to build up the basics of your economy, and that includes helping your small manufacturers through these various customized services like the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, and also investing in the skills of your local workforce. And to do that requires local leadership that can mobilize those local resources, and it also requires a supportive environment where state government, the federal government, help local areas that may not have the resources themselves to provide these kind of services.
That's Tim Bartik, a senior economist with the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. I want to thank him, along with economist Jared Bernstein. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As the school year comes to a close, many of you listening out there may have kids involved in sports who are going to continue to practice and train all summer long. Or maybe this is the time of year they pick up a new sport, be that swimming, soccer, or baseball. This is a good thing, something we encourage when it comes to making friends and spending time outdoors. But is there such a thing as playing too much sports? We're going to talk about now how to reduce injury and burnout in youth sports, and we'd love for you listening to join us. If you have a story to share of your child, give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21st Show. Our handle is 21st Show. Joining us for this conversation is Dr. Cynthia LaBella. She's a pediatric orthopedist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and Lurie Children's Hospital. Brendan McHale is here with me in studio in Urbana. He's the supervisor of sports medicine and athletic training services at the Carl Foundation Hospital. And on the line with us from Bloomington is Kurt Gibson, the associate executive director of the Illinois High School Association. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Dr. LaBella, I wanted to start with you. What are you seeing in terms of trends towards students specializing in just one sport throughout the year? Is that more common these days?
It's definitely more common these days than when I grew up decades ago. The culture has changed quite a bit. There are so many more opportunities, I think, for kids to play a sport year-round. You know, years ago, you played the sport during its season. And, for instance, there wasn't an opportunity to play basketball outside of the basketball season, or baseball outside of the baseball season, or soccer. But now you can pick any of those sports, and there are indoor facilities and leagues and that you can play in year-round. So the opportunities have greatly expanded.
And as the opportunities have expanded, I imagine you've seen injuries expand as well, Dr. Labella?
Well, that's a great question. I think that there's a lot of research now focused on that to see if, with expansion of all these opportunities and parents and kids taking advantage of them, are we seeing an increase in injuries? And so there are a few studies that suggest that, especially with sports that require repetition of one specific movement over and over again to perfect a skill. So an example would be something like tennis or baseball, where you're throwing the ball or swinging the racket again and again, that can put some wear and tear on the body if you're doing that year-round. So there is some concern that overuse injuries are becoming more prevalent because there is not as much downtime for the body to repair tissues and recover and heal.
And we're going to talk about particular what that means for younger bodies in a moment. But Brenton, I wanted to ask you what you're seeing at Carle Foundation when it comes to our younger athletes.
We're seeing some of what Dr. Labella had mentioned, but there's also that transition period when they're going from one sport to the next. In that transition time, they're not used to the demands of the new sport that they are transitioning into. So sometimes if we have some athletes that want to take it a little too fast and try to accelerate their, whether it be their learning curve of that particular sport or just practice a little bit more, and the body's not used to that, the demands of that particular sport, that we'll see some injuries there. And sometimes, I mean, it can be a chronic thing, or something can turn into a chronic thing. But most of these acute injuries will hopefully, if the young athlete is smart about it, will be able to bounce back from that injury, and it won't be with them forever.
Kurt, I wanted to bring you into this conversation with IHSA. That's the body that regulates competition in most high school sports and a few other activities. Are coaches, do you think, it makes sense that I think coaches oftentimes might encourage students to focus on one sport. Do you think that youth sports are getting more competitive than they used to be in the past?
Well, I think without a doubt they're getting much more competitive. I'm finishing my 16th year here at our office, and I would say over that time, the growth of non-school programs has been the biggest challenge that we face internally here at our office, that our member schools face. And I do think there was a time when coaches were trying to influence their better athletes to focus on one sport throughout an entire school year. But I think we're starting to see that trend starting to change, and change in a good way. We're hearing more and more about schools working with their student bodies and their coaching staffs to encourage multi-sport participation and trying to get students to move away from this idea of putting all my eggs in one athletic basket.
But, Kurt, you mentioned also programs outside of high school. I wonder how much, especially, we're seeing kids who, I'm thinking of the young people in my family who are focusing on basketball and then are playing basketball, not just in school, but in other leagues. Are we seeing that a lot, kids playing in leagues that are outside of school as well, hoping to improve their game, get college scholarships, those sorts of things?
That does seem to be still happening, yes.
Dr. Labella, I wonder what role you see parents playing in all of this. Do we think that parents are pushing kids, or certainly there are kids who are also, this is something they really want to do as well?
Well, I've seen it both situations, actually. Every family's a little different, but I've seen situations where it's the kid pushing the parents to sign them up for all these things, and I've seen other situations where the parent is really pushing the kid to sign up for things year-round. So I think it's nice. We have the opportunity in our clinic to get to know patients and families, unfortunately, when they have an injury, but then there's always a discussion about prevention after they get better and sending them back to sports. And then we get to know the family and the kid, and we can kind of counsel appropriately depending on who's the one kind of driving this year-round training and focus and emphasize the need for breaks periodically to let the body kind of rest and recover and heal.
And Brenton, I wanted to ask you about that. When we're talking about breaks and the need for the body to rest and heal, when we're thinking particularly about young people, how important is that?
It's very important. And I think the best way to approach it is have more of a team approach where we can always ask the children to listen to their bodies, but sometimes they're not going to be able to do that because they don't know quite what to listen for, whether it be, you know, not necessarily swelling, but something that turns from an ache into an injury. And that's why it's really important that the parents have a good communication with them about practice and then getting the coach involved. So if we have all of those individuals working at making sure that these kids are improving and not overdoing it, and sometimes they just need sometimes just a day off or a little bit of a break from a sport and kind of get rested up and be able to respond the way that everyone wants them to.
We're talking about youth sports and about injuries that can happen if you don't take a break when you are young. Dr. Cynthia LaBella is on the line from Chicago, where she's a pediatric orthopedist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and Lurie Children's Hospital. In studio with me here in Urbana is Brendan Hale, who's a supervisor of sports medicine and athletic training services at Carle Foundation Hospital. And on the line from Bloomington, Kurt Gibson is with us with the Illinois High School Association. Dr. LaBella, can you help us understand a little bit more of what happens when breaks don't happen, as Brendan is saying, and particularly when we're thinking about, you alluded to this earlier, it's young people, their bodies are still growing. What kind of impact injuries can have on a growing body?
Sure. We watch young people running around out there, and we think they're endless energy, and they can keep going forever. So it's easy to forget that they need breaks, too. And the suggestion of at least one day off per week is definitely something that we recommend. And it doesn't mean you have to sit on the couch for that day. It just means
not playing that sport. Right.
Exactly. Not doing some intense, strenuous training or a supervised practice or competition. So, you know, you can go out and walk or ride your bike or go for a swim. Something recreational would be a very healthy thing to do to let your body sort of rest and recover. And it's during those rest and recovery times that your body's tissues repair themselves. You know, every time you go out and do a two-hour strenuous practice, whether it's a soccer practice or baseball or gymnastics, there's a little bit of tissue breakdown in your muscles, your bones. And your body uses that 24 hours in between from one workout to the next to repair all those tissues and make them stronger. And that's how you build bone density from being active, and you build muscle strength from being involved in sports and physical activity. If you don't give your body that break to rebuild that tissue, eventually it does start to break down, and the wear and tear can produce what we call an overuse injury to any of those structures. You can get a stress fracture in a bone from too much stress on the bone. You can get a tendonitis from too much stress on a tendon or a strain in the muscle. So all of those things can happen in kids. One thing that makes kids unique is, you mentioned, they're still growing. So number one, they need some of that energy that they're expending on sports. Some of that energy has to go to growth of the tissues, right? Because their bones are getting longer and their muscles are getting bigger just because they're growing. So they need that to conserve energy for growth. But also they have growth centers in their bones that are uniquely vulnerable to overuse injuries. Those little growth plates can definitely break down sooner and start to become painful sooner in a kid. So it's something for parents to be aware of, and certainly this whole idea of pushing through pain, that should never be a mantra for a child. If they're starting to have pain, especially around a joint, that's a sign that they're doing too much and they need to back off a little bit.
Brendan, what kind of things do you tell parents and as well as parents or caregivers or other adults in kids' lives? It is a hard balance, right? Because I think you obviously no one wants their child to be in pain, but at the same time you have to try to figure out how to manage the pain versus continuing to play.
Right. Well, the biggest thing, if they are sore, there's a reason why, and that's the body trying to tell us they need to take a little break. And some of those injuries can happen not just from physically being fatigued, but also mentally, because if they're exhausted or tired from lack of sleep or just lack of, you know, just constantly going, If they're not eating a well-balanced diet, that doesn't give them the fuel that they need to do or to be successful in whatever it is they're practicing or playing. So there's a lot of things that contribute to the injury, and it's not, you know, everyone likes to easily focus on the fatigue factor physically, but there's also some mental issues in there, and that's why sleep habits are incredibly important, as well as nutritional habits.
Kurt, when we think about coaches in IHSA, what kind of messages is IHSA giving coaches to be on the lookout for this and helping? Because coaches play a huge role in student athletes' lives as well.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Our Sports Medicine Advisory Committee has had some initial discussions on how to best communicate to schools the importance of emphasizing this need for students to give themselves physical rest, as well as the mental rest we're talking about. I think there's even another side to that that's not being discussed. You know, students who are through this extended participation in one sport, trying to pursue perhaps college scholarship, they're putting themselves under tremendous mental strain. And we're starting to see and hear from our schools now the first signs of some maybe mental health issues that need to be addressed. You know, when students begin to feel excessive pressure, they might turn to other activities like drugs or drinking that might, you know, be a release for them because they're on the go so much. And I'm certainly not trying to insinuate in all cases, but it's an sometimes overlooked part of the rest piece that we've been discussing. But from our sports medicine standpoint, we've been having some initial discussions on how we can best communicate to schools and help put resources in their hands to remind their students of the importance of not only getting rest, but trying to develop their whole bodies and being multi-sport athletes. We're hearing more and more stories of schools offering incentives, special letters to seniors who play three sports over each of their 4 years in high school. So I think there's really beginning to become a new trend to emphasize multi-sport participation and involvement in more than just one program than we've seen in probably the last 10 to 15 years.
Kurt, what advice do you have for parents on this front, particularly when you're talking about the mental health aspects of this?
I think you have to let your sons and daughters find their way. And I say that as a father of four sons who, you know, grew up playing sports. You want to see your children do well. I get that. You want them to be successful. But whether they pursue an athletic, you know, pursuit or not, it's not a reflection on you as a parent. You know, I think our concern as parents should be more, what kind of person are we, you know, helping to mold our young children into, and worry less about whether they get that scholarship. Worry more about them being a good, well-rounded person. And that would be sort of a message I would offer to parents. Let the students sort of dictate where they want to go, how serious they want their involvement to be.
Dr. Labella, what about you? What advice do you have for parents who are listening in on this conversation?
Oh, sure. I echo everything that Kurt just said. I think that sports are a tremendous benefit for kids for multiple reasons, both physically, mentally, socially. But we need to balance that with other things that they pursue. And so I think that we advise parents to make sure there's a balance in their child's life and that they have time for social activities with friends and academic pursuits as well as their sports. So that's a big focus. And as Kurt mentioned, following the child. You know, sometimes a parent may have a dream for the child, but that's not exactly matching with what the child is choosing. And I'm a parent too, and that can be hard, but that's the challenge. And I think that if we start doing that with our kids, we'll follow them to success because they're the ones driving it then.
And Brendan, to your point also, making sure that kids also learn to recognize the signs of their own bodies as well. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank Brendan McHale with Carl Foundation Hospital, Northwestern University's Dr. Cynthia Labelle, and IHSA's Kurt Gibson for being with me to talk about this. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
So stay tuned. Coming up on the 21st, we're going to be talking about summer movies. What's worth your time this summer? You're listening to the 21st. We'll start that conversation just after the break.
Creatures were here before us. And if we're not careful, they're gonna be here after.
The Nick you're dating is Nick Young?
Yeah, you guys know them or something?
Hells yeah. They're just the biggest developers in all of Singapore.
Damn, Rachel. It's like the Asian Bachelor.
These people aren't just rich, they're crazy rich.
You really should have told me that you're like the Prince William of Asia.
That's ridiculous. Much more of a Harry.
I have never felt closer to Mom. I'm in the exact same place that she was all those years ago.
You're pregnant?
Yeah, I am.
Tonight, it's a night for celebration.
Come on, let's get this show on the road.
I was told you couldn't come. I'm a spontaneous person. No, you're not. No, I'm not.
You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. And those were clips from Jurassic World 2, Crazy Rich Asians, and Mamma Mia 2. Are you ready for some of these summer movies? When it's too hot to be outside, there's nothing like stepping inside a cool movie theater. And lucky for us, this is the time of year when studios are releasing a lot of blockbusters. But which are worth seeing and which are not? Reggie Ponder has his answers. He's with us from our studios at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in Evanston. And as always, we want to hear from you. Tweet us your favorite movies you're looking forward to this summer and why. Our handle's 21STShow. Reggie Ponder, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
It's the beginning of summer. Now we can talk summer movies.
We can. I do want to throw out a disclaimer is that the summer gets longer all the time. And so when we talk about summer movies, one of the movies we probably won't be talking about is Avengers Infinity War because it's not technically in the summer season, but it did do a whopping $630 million at the box office.
Unlike Star Wars Solo Story, which this weekend didn't do so great. $103 million domestically, overseas only $65 million. Do you think Disney and Lucasfilm are going to have to rethink their strategy with the franchise, Reggie?
I don't. I think that they're doing something very, very similar to what they do with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is have these kind of one-off movies that hopefully will get some people excited, maybe bring some other people into the franchise. It might piss off some people who really love the franchise, but I don't think that it makes them go away from the franchise. This was a movie for me that if I never saw it, it wouldn't have mattered to me as it relates to the Star Wars franchise at all.
And I felt like it was a little bit like fan fiction. It was interesting. I saw it this weekend with someone who was not at all familiar with the Star Wars franchise, so that was also entertaining. Actually, we have a little clip from Star Wars. Let's hear some of that.
You played before?
A couple times, yeah.
Captain Lando Calrissian.
Han Solo.
Looks like you're having a good day.
I'm a lucky guy.
Can I ask you a question, Captain Calrissian?
Anything, Han?
It's Han, but that's okay. I heard a story about you. I was wondering if it's true.
Everything you've heard about me is true.
All right, that's a young Han of Solo, A Star Wars Story with Lando Calrissian. Reggie, I feel like the title characters were great, okay, but I think Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian and then his robot friend, the droid lady, kind of stole the show for me.
I think they did a really good job. I love Donald Glover's character. And for me, there's two characters that I liked. I actually liked Woody Harrelson's character as well. So those were the two characters that stood out for me. I was interested in seeing what they were doing and the banter going back and forth. So I agree with you. I think that Donald Glover stole the show, but I would not count out a Woody Harrelson on this one. Yeah, that was Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who played L-337.
L-337. All right, we're not going to give it away if you haven't seen it. They were my favorite part. I thought it was very fun. It's kind of, and I think this is the thing about these summer movies, right, Reggie? That's a movie that it's fun, but it's obviously more fun if you see it in the theater because of all of the action.
Yes, and it's important, actually, for the theaters to do this type of thing from a blockbuster perspective. One of the things I talked to you about before is that the movie theaters in sheer ticket sales, not in terms of actually revenue, is decreasing. So they need to get people into the theaters, and the blockbuster movies are the ones that do that because they look so great on the big screen. It's a massive, expansive, all that, and you're just so excited to see it. So yes, this is one of those movies you would want to see on the big screen.
So when we're talking about blockbusters, and you mentioned Avengers Infinity War, I feel like blockbusters have become a little formulaic. Maybe they've always been this way, but I feel like particularly so in the past couple of years where we have a sequel and then we have a one that we know is going to be a hit, so it turns into a sequel, whether it's the Marvel Universe or Jurassic World, actually. Maybe, I don't know if that was a surprising blockbuster of a reboot and now we have the sequel.
So I think your first statement is right, is that from a blockbuster perspective, it's definitely formulaic. We get so many of these things where you're like a Transformers 1. And it's bang, bang, blow them up, all that stuff. And you know it's coming, but people like those kind of movies, so they go out to see them. But the other thing is that I would take exception with the Marvel Universe, is that I don't think it's as formulaic, because what they did is they built that universe over time. So you get the Hulk movie, you get Iron Man, and so they built all these people to come into the Avengers family, and then all of a sudden they're outside of that. So I think that they actually had some strategy beyond just being formulaic as it relates to the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
But we do have lots of sequels that are out this summer, whether it's Deadpool or Jurassic Park or Incredibles. Which of those are your favorite? What are you looking forward to in the sequel world?
Okay, so if you haven't seen Deadpool and you like Deadpool 1, go see it. It is
what
fun.
If you haven't seen it? I haven't seen the original Deadpool. And then I can thank the Comcast guy for completely ruining Deadpool 2 because he said the name of it. He told me, not the name, he said the ending. He told me what happened at the end.
So go see it anyway, because this Deadpool is one of those movies that if you like that type of humor, you will be, it's refreshing, because he breaks that fourth wall and all the fifth wall. I mean, they do all the type of stuff that you are not supposed to do in a movie, and they make fun of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And so if there's some references in there that are just so great. So I would say if you haven't seen Deadpool 2, go see it. But here's a couple of movies.
Oh, hold on a second. We're going to play a little clip of Deadpool. Let's listen to that.
Everyone calm down. The pros are here. We're the X-Men.
What are you doing?
My job. You're the one who said I was ready, and I frankly disagreed with you. But here we are, trying to overcome our differences. Like Beyonce says, please. Please stop cheating on me.
Okay, so that's Deadpool. I'm here with real critic Reggie Ponder. We're talking summer movies. What else are you thinking, Reggie, in terms of sequels?
Firstly, okay, for sequels, I am excited about Incredibles 2. I just call me a kid at heart. I enjoyed the Incredibles. I want to see this one. I don't know what they're going to do, but I already know I'm going to like it. I'm sorry. I hate to tell you I'm going to like it. A Jurassic World, I'm not geeked about seeing it, but I am curious as to what they're going to do with this one. How are you going to keep me excited about that particular film? But Equalizer 2 with Denzel Washington, let me tell you, this weekend my wife and I are going to New York to see Denzel in Iceman cometh. Now, you know we want to see him in Equalizer 2. Come on. I can't wait. I can't
wait. You want to see him in both.
Yes. So can't wait to see him in that. So those are the sequels that I'm really looking forward to seeing.
What about, is it Sicario?
Oh, I forgot to mention Sicario. So if you didn't see Sicario.
I did not see Sicario 1.
No, say it isn't so. Say it isn't so. So Sicario 1 is really about this FBI agent who's enlisted by the government task force to aid in the escalating war on drugs. And it's about at the U.S. and Mexico border. It had Emily Blunt and Josh Brolin in it. And it was really good. It was one of those kind of movies that kept you, your heart was beating as to what was going to happen next in this movie. It was written by Taylor Sheridan and directed by Denis Villeneuve. He is not directing the second one. So now we're at the second one, which is the war has escalated. It's bigger and better and more intense. And there's some different folks in this movie. So we still have Josh Brolin who's in it, but Emily Blunt isn't. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out on the big screen. But I am very much looking forward to that one as a sequel as well.
I know who you are. You're the attorney whose family they killed.
Not they.
My father. And now you hunt them.
Adios.
We're talking about summer movies with Reggie Ponder, the Real Critic. You can tweet along with us at 21STShow. Tell us what you're looking forward to. Reggie, when we're thinking about, we've talked about sequels, threequels. What are you most excited about when it comes to original films?
So this is not original, but I am very excited about Ocean's 8 because it's not a sequel, but it's part of a franchise, but it's all women. It's a women heist film.
With Rihanna.
Rihanna, that's fine. But you have Sandra Bullock, Kate Blanchett, Rihanna, Helen Bonham Carter, Anne Hathaway, Mindy Kaling, Sarah Paulson. This is going to be a very, very fun movie. Even if it's not fantastically done, it's going to be a fun movie. So I'm really looking forward to that one. I'm also looking forward to Superfly with Trevor Jackson. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out. I'm also looking forward to, I love the Marvel Cinematic Universe, so I'm looking forward to Ant-Man and the Wasp. And the reason here is that I really like the fact that they just didn't do Ant-Man. They made it Ant-Man and the Wasp, and I am very, very happy. I think with Marvel, a lot of these comic book companies are figuring out is that women absolutely want to see other women as superheroes, and they did so well with DC did so well with Wonder Woman that they made this Ant-Man and the Wasp, and I'm very, very happy about that. So I'm looking forward to that as well. There's so many other movies, so I'll just mention two real quick. There's a movie called Sorry to Bother You, and it's really about a black guy who ends up doing so well because his voice sounds quote unquote white as he's selling. And I'm looking forward to see how that plays out. It's an indie film, so I'm looking forward to that as well. But there's so many out there, so I'll stop there for a moment.
Well, I love the Ant-Man. I love how creative. You're right about how creative Marvel has been with that series. But I have to tell you, the movie I'm most excited about, we just have about a minute left, is Crazy Rich Asians.
Yes, thank you for saying that. I am very interested in this one because I'm interested in, will I like it as a non-Asian, but will Asians not like it because it might be come across as stereotypical? And the reason it might be offensive is because we don't have a lot of films from an Asian perspective. So it might be a true story, but it might show just this one side of the story and be offensive to some Asians. So I'm really interested not only in seeing the film, but in the social impact that it has in the market.
And I think if you've read the books, which I have, it's, you kind of take them for what they are, right? Because it's, the book is a fantastic kind of, if it is, it's not chick lit, but it's kind of in that genre of a really fun read. So I think people will look at them. It's one of those books that you read and think this will probably be even more fun movie. So we will see what happens.
So your family is rich?
Quite comfortable.
That is exactly what a super rich person would say.
1.2 million.
The Nick you're dating is Nick Young?
Yeah, you guys know them or something?
Hells yeah. They're just the biggest developers in all of Singapore.
Damn, Rachel. It's like the Asian Bachelor.
These people aren't just rich. They're crazy rich.
Lots of movies to look forward to this summer. I want to thank Reggie Ponder for giving us a brief overview of some of the blockbusters, at least. He's the Real Critic. That's R-E-E-L. Reggie, thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much. I look forward to talking to you again.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stShow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.